everyone, and welcome to episode 2 of the Bob's Tech Site podcast. So this podcast starts off with recent news in the Linux, free software, and technology world in general. Then I dive into a main topic. Then I talk about my own personal projects, because this is the Bob's Tech Site podcast. I'm going to be blogging about my stuff, so it kind of makes sense to talk about it. And then at the end, we have some bi-monthly shoutouts. After a successful pilot back in January, we've returned with a brand new soundtrack, better voice recording equipment, and a new bi-monthly schedule, and by bi-monthly I mean once every 2 months, that I'm determined that I'm going to stick to. Also, you'll notice that with the new soundtrack, we've got a slightly calmer, sort of more classical tone. It should hopefully be a little bit less punchy than the previous soundtrack. Also, it kind of makes up for the fact that I briefly lost the original files, but managed to recover them from a backup yesterday. However, I quite like the new soundtrack, and I think you'll like the new stings as we go through this as well. I'd also like to thank, by the way, all the people that sent me feedback about this podcast. In particular, the Americans that seem to absolutely love my British accent. So for them, here's a few lovely examples of Britishisms that I can sort of just recite. And, you know, you can listen to those on loop if you want. I'm completely fine with that. And, you know, if it amuses you, just go on ahead. So, without further ado, aluminium. Jolly good old chap. Right, moving swiftly on, let's move on to the news. See, wasn't that a lovely new sting? It's, you know, kind of classy and elegant and... Anyway, moving swiftly on. Apparently, Age of Empires Definitive Edition, which is the latest HD remake of the classic original Age of Empires game originally released in the mid to late 90s, arrived on the 20th of February. Unfortunately, for most gaming fans, it only runs on Windows 10. It can only be downloaded through the Windows Store, and you kind of need to use Xbox Live in order to do multiplayer because you can't download it through Steam. This is obviously less than great for those of us who are running gaming rigs that don't run Windows 10. For example, me. Mine currently runs Windows 8.1. Thankfully, however, the original does still work if you happen to have an install of that, or if you pull it down from GOG or somewhere similar. Those of you who are running Linux or Mac, you can also run it on Wine, so that's always another alternative. It does miss out on a few things. For example, the latest HD remake introduces new pathfinding, the AI is a little bit smarter, plus you can also attack and move at the same time, which is very cool. But, you know, I'm not sure necessarily if it still retains the same cheats as the original, so whether or not you can conjure up a baby on a tricycle that's going to wander around with a machine gun is one that remains to be seen, and it'll be interesting to see if that was something that was continued into the latest remake. Next on our list of news is that Slack is apparently closing down its XMPP and IRC gateways. The reasoning behind this is that apparently those particular platforms don't support the new features they've introduced into their main application, like shared channels, emoji, and the new threads mechanic. Obviously, this has caused a little bit of despair in the open source communities because IRC and XMPP are, IRC certainly is widely used, and XMPP is something which the community is kind of trying to revive. But unfortunately, it looks like Slack is not going to be a part of those plans at all. It's a shame, really, because rumor has it that Slack actually started off with IRC as its back end. It doesn't use it anymore, but it certainly started that way. So one could say that perhaps Slack stood on the shoulders of open source, created a closed source product, and then potentially, you know, kind of threw up the drawbridge and decided, actually, we're withdrawing from this now because it's no longer convenient. But, you know, that sort of comes with the territory when you work with these sort of walled garden, closed protocols. And for the vast majority of Slack users, I guess they're not going to notice much of a difference, but this does potentially affect people who had certain accessibility needs. Slack has tried to hype its own accessibility dashboards, but it remains to be seen how useful or not these actually are for those who need them. Anyway, moving on to the next news item. FreeBSD introduced a new code of conduct, which caused quite the stir. They adapted it from a template that was produced by the Geek Feminism Wiki, and this generated a new controversy that was dubbed Huggate. So apparently, on one of the lines of the code of conduct, it said that sending virtual hugs without consent was not okay. Brian Lunduk produced a video all about this particular subject, and certainly on Reddit and on various forums, there was a real stink that was kicked up by it. However, on my own investigations when I looked through things like mailing lists and forums, the actual FreeBSD community seemed largely fine with it. The most egregious criticism seemed to come from outside the FreeBSD community, so I don't think it's really going to impact its user base, and I suspect it's probably not going to impact the developers that are actively working on it. And if it fosters a more diverse community and a community that's a bit more accepting of people from different walks of life, then perhaps that's only going to be a positive thing. And on to our next news item, which is Ubuntu is apparently going to be introducing some data collection, which requires users to opt out rather than opt in. And part of this data collection is going to be Ubuntu and Canonical collecting hardware data for every Ubuntu install from version 8.04 onwards. There's also going to be certain tools that are installed as well in the background, which will monitor which applications you install on the system and how long you use them for. Other such tidbits that might be picked up will be your geographic location, although apparently there's going to be nothing that's personally identifying, and there will be nothing that's linked specifically to your IP address. You can also opt out of it by unchecking a box during the install stage, and then after the install you would go into the Ubuntu settings, and in the privacy section you would be able to disable these options. However, there's a certain uneasiness within the community, because typically data like this can be leaked, and of course any data collection system may inevitably have vulnerabilities that could be exploited. However, Canonical have tried to assuage concerns by saying that they're going to publish the data they've collected in an aggregated and anonymous way. And of course, if it's all going to be based on open source tooling, then we can all investigate the source code that they're using to gather the data. So it'll be interesting to see whether or not this is something that is carried forward from candidate stage actually into the distribution itself, or if this is something that the community becomes concerned about and actively starts boycotting Ubuntu over. And as our final news item, the very first Linux-friendly RISC-V board is being released. So for those of you who aren't familiar with RISC-V, this is a completely open hardware platform that's designed to rival, well, that's intended to rival ARM and the x86 family of processors. Obviously, as you can guess from the name, it's based on the reduced instruction set. And the great thing about it is that it's not vulnerable to Spectre and Meltdown, because it doesn't need to support legacy in the same way, and its architecture is constructed differently. This particular board is called the Hi5 Unleashed, and it's released by a company called Sci5, and it's currently available to pre-order from a company called CrowdSupply. In terms of raw hardware specs, it's a 64-bit quad-core processor running at 1.5 GHz, and it's been dubbed the Freedom U540 chip. The board itself will have 8 GB of RAM on board with 32 MB of flash storage. There'll also be a microSD slot, gigabit Ethernet, and an FMC adapter for expansion. However, there is no GPU or VDU, so this is something which would need to be added yourself. The actual board will be retailing at $999, and it's going to start shipping from the 30th of June 2018. So, on to our main topic for this episode. Originally, I was going to do this on my career in technology to date. However, I realised that this was probably not going to be something that could fit into a single podcast, so I'm currently going away and rethinking that, possibly for episode 3. So just for this episode, what I'm going to look at are some frequently asked tech questions and some fallacies with GNU/Linux, which I've encountered in the past, and I thought I'd address those in this episode. So without further ado, we'll have a look at the first question, which is, isn't GNU/Linux a command line operating system that only hardcore nerds use? Now, it's true that Linux runs on pretty much everything that isn't a desktop, so whether that's a server, or a microcontroller, or a little cable box that's underneath your TV, or your car, basically anything that could be an embedded device is probably running some variation of Linux on it, and in those cases, yes, absolutely, it's a command line operating system. However, if you want to use it on a desktop, it doesn't have to run as a command line operating system, and in fact for many years hasn't. Using things like Ubuntu, for example, that has the GNOME desktop included by default. You've also got all kinds of other distributions that have different desktops like KDE, XFCE, Mate, or Mate, however that's pronounced, and LXDE, and a whole bunch of others which I could probably rattle off the top of my head. And these are all intended to provide a desktop-style operating system. In fact, Linux has had a desktop operating system it can run since the early thousands. So if you still think it's a DOS-like operating system, my suggestion would be take a look at some screenshots or have a look at DistroWatch, because there's plenty of distributions out there with some very good desktops and some very good graphical user applications as well. I mean, just take a look at Firefox and LibreOffice. These run on pretty much every platform, and they're all graphical user interfaces. So if you're using them on Windows, chances are you could probably use it on Linux as well. So on to the next question, which is, I'm completely new to GNU/Linux. Which distribution would you recommend to me? So it depends on what you want to do. So if you're just somebody who literally just wants to edit documents and browse the web, then my suggestion would be Elementary, because this has got a really attractive looking interface, and because it's based on the Ubuntu LTS, it runs on pretty much everything. And the great thing is that you don't really need to touch the command line very much either. All the inbuilt graphical tools are actually really intuitive, and I would trust a completely non-technical user to be able to use that system. Now, if you want a bit more of a broad kind of operating system that's supported by everything, I would suggest Ubuntu. I know that at the moment there's some changes happening with it where it's shifting from the Unity desktop to the GNOME Shell desktop, and I'm not the biggest fan of GNOME Shell, but it's one of those things where I'll probably end up having to get used to it sooner or later. The great thing about Ubuntu is it has a fantastic support community, and if you find that you're getting a bit tired of it or you don't like the particular software collection, there are a huge number of distros that are based off it. So try a few distributions out, see what you think of them. Particularly when you start moving to the more hardcore stuff, you might, for example, want to try out Fedora, because Fedora always has the new shinies that Red Hat are currently testing out. There's also OpenSUSE. That's another potential option. And then when you get to a real advanced user stage, and you happen to get to that phase where you just want to control everything, then you've got Arch Linux and Gentoo as well. Although, I think for me personally, I went full circle. I tried Arch and Gentoo briefly in late 2009, early 2010, and then went, yeah, this isn't for me. I want an operating system where I can do actual work on it, rather than spending most of my time updating it. But each to their own. If it works for you, that's fantastic. So the next question I've got here is, should I try fully free distributions like Triskel GNU/Linux? In principle to that, my answer is yes. However, for that to work, you have to make certain sacrifices. So for one thing, it's not going to work on every single piece of hardware, because a lot of hardware requires non-free drivers. And if you've not got a system that can work only with free drivers, then you're going to have problems running Triskel. Thankfully, there's companies like Technoethical that actually sell you ready-made machines and reconditioned Lenovo ThinkPads that will actually run Triskel just fresh out of the box, and it looks lovely. The other thing as well is that when you're running Triskel, you also have to accept that you're not going to be running the latest and greatest software. Triskel 7, I believe, is currently running off Ubuntu 14.04, although the next version, Triskel 8, will be based on 16.04. You'll notice from the previous news items that the next version, 18.04, actually comes out in a month or so. So, as you can see, it's an LTS version behind. So, expect your software to not necessarily be bleeding edge, but you'll have a really, truly stable system, because every single bug that could be ironed out is probably ironed out by that point. Also, you kind of have to make sacrifices in terms of the things that you want to do with that system. So if you want to play Steam games, Triskel is not going to be the system for you, because Steam just on its own requires non-free components, and all the games that you want to play from Steam will also need non-free components in addition. Also, if you're going to go online, you'll notice that certain sites won't work properly, because they require non-free components in order to function, like Flash, for example. And also, if you want to watch Netflix or YouTube through your browser, that's probably not going to work. So you would need to download separate client applications, perhaps, that would work with that. And if you start running non-free applications on top of your fully free system, then one would question why you're running Triskel in the first place. But if you are committed to trying to go fully free, even if it's just on one particular box, give it a go. Even if it's... I haven't personally tried it on VirtualBox, but that's another potential option you could go down as well. I had Triskel running at the start of this year on an old Dell Optiplex desktop, and it basically turned this nearly 10-year-old machine into a perfectly usable productivity machine. And in fact, I recorded the first podcast on that. The only reason I'm not using it right now is because unfortunately the PSU died, and the recyclers who previously had reconditioned that desktop had made some very silly decisions, like gluing panels together and adding Velcro and putting in weird custom fittings that broke things. It was an interesting setup, to say the least. But I am looking at ways that I can run Triskel natively again. It doesn't run on this current gaming rig that I'm recording this podcast on. But, you know, I'm sort of trying to shift my way back towards fully free. So we'll see in future episodes how well I do with that. So my next question is, what advice would you give to a trainee software developer? So it depends on what stage of your training you've got to. So if you're somebody who's literally just at school taking their GCSEs, and when I say secondary school, that's the British equivalent of high school, my suggestion would be to do your A-levels or your BTEC National Diploma, but instead of going and chasing a degree at a university, try and get in contact with a big company like a Capgemini or a BT or someone like that, and try and get a degree-level apprenticeship. Because the great thing about that is that you'll earn real-world experience, you'll also be on a proper salary, and you'll be working 4 days a week, and then you'll have one day where you're on day release, and you get your degree, but you rack up no debt as a result of doing that. It's true that you will miss out on the typical student life, so you won't be living in halls, and you won't be necessarily going out on all the student nights, unless that's something that would be facilitated by your current role. But by the time you've graduated, and by the time you finish your apprenticeship, you're well ahead of everyone else, because as I said, no debt, you've got a degree, and you've got real-world experience. That, to me, seems like the most sensible route to go. If you're looking at languages to learn, which is the next question, incidentally, then it depends on the kind of work that you want to do. So if you want to be a web developer, learn Node and Ruby. Just bear in mind that if you do learn those programming languages, you'll pretty much be typecast as a front-end web developer forever. There are a few companies that will happily accommodate you becoming more of a full-stack developer, but those jobs can sometimes be few and far between. Now, if you want a more sort of general software role, my suggestion would be Java or C#. Now, C# will obviously push you more towards the Windows stack, whereas Java gives you a little bit more flexibility. And if you're a good Java developer, you can make an absolute killing, particularly in the finance industry. That's one that I've typically avoided because I didn't want to live in London. But if you're perfectly willing to do that, you can make an absolute killing that way. Now, if you want to move more towards the hardware engineering side of things, then you'd probably want to learn C and C++. However, I should stress, if you haven't learned any programming language whatsoever, start off with Python. I mean, I've gone into schools and I've taught a class full of teenagers how to program in an afternoon just using Python. And on top of that, as somebody who has to work with Java full-time every single day, it's the language I work with when I get home, because it's one that I can use for fun, because you can spin up things really quickly, but it's also a surprisingly extensible language as well, because of things like C bindings, and also because of its huge library. There's not much of a limit of the things which you can actually do with it. On top of that as well, if you happen to have a Raspberry Pi, you can also do a bit of hardware hacking with it, which is really cool. So the next question I've got is, how can I contribute to open source and free software projects? So the two most obvious ways is you can donate to them on a recurring basis, and also you can dedicate your own time. Because if you spot bugs, the best thing you can do is go and report them. And if you've also got the ability to go in and actually fix the bugs and include that as a pull request as well, that's even better. Obviously, you'll need to learn how to use things like GitHub before you can do that, but that's one way you can contribute. However, one thing which free software projects are sorely missing at the moment are technical writers and documentation. So if you're able to contribute documentation and blog posts and guides for how to do things, that can be really beneficial to an open source project as well. Also, just spreading the word and saying, I found this fantastic free software alternative to this horrible proprietary program that everybody kind of hates but still feels that they kind of have to pay for. That's also going to be hugely beneficial to that project. So that's another way you can contribute as well. The other thing you can do as well is, you know, have a look on the mailing lists or the IRC channels or on the official website for a particular project, because chances are they probably have a list of things they probably need help with. You can just jump in, try and cover some of that stuff. Okay, and the final question, which is one I get on a fairly regular basis, is how much traffic does Bob's Tech Site get? I don't collect in-depth data. You'll notice when you go on Bob's Tech Site, Google Analytics isn't a thing. So essentially, the two places where I collect data, the first one is Feedburner, just to see how many people are following the podcast, and I just check that every so often. But the way that I know rough traffic numbers is I go onto my Cloudflare dashboard. And that gives me a rough overview of how many people are hitting the site. So I can give you an average, but I'm just going to go on Cloudflare right now, and we'll take a look. So, just in the past month, I've had approximately 50,000 requests in total to my website. And that translates to roughly 6,100 unique visitors, or somewhere approaching 225 per day just over the past month or so. That's slightly above average, I suspect, probably because I've been pushing out a lot of content. It normally sort of drops down to about 4,000 unique visitors per month. So in theory, if I was somebody who was really into pushing adverts on my site, I'm sure that would probably generate some revenue. But it's not something I'm really into, because at the end of the day, it's a personal blog, and I'm going to be cutting down the cost of running it in the next month or so by taking advantage of DigitalOcean's new pricing structure. At the moment, I'm on one of their old $10 per month VPSs. I'm hoping to drop down to one of their $5 ones, because that roughly halves the cost of my web hosting for the year, which will be fantastic. moving swiftly on to my personal projects. Masterdome 0.1 was released back in January, just at the end of that month. So for those who missed the original pilot for this series, Masterdome is basically a desktop client that I was writing for Mastodon, and 0.1 was just intended as a sort of very basic sort of prototype. It essentially allows you to send a plain text to up to 280 characters. It reads the home, local, and public streams, and it also brings up a list of notifications as well. The main sort of focus that I had on it originally was just to make sure that you could log in, log out, store credentials, and that this was a thing that would be possible with Python. And I'm glad to say that it was, and the prototype is there. Anybody can go ahead and just download it from GitHub. What I'm planning to do with 0.2, and this is probably going to take about a month or two, so it'll probably be early May-ish that it'll probably arrive, is I'm going to be re-engineering the way that it talks to Mastodon, which is the free software decentralized alternative to Twitter. Because the library I was using before, unfortunately, isn't complete and doesn't support multi-factor authentication. So I'm going to be writing my own sort of mini library that will do just these raw REST calls. And the great thing about that will mean that when I want to support other platforms later, like, for example, GNU Social and indeed Twitter, it should make my life a little bit simpler. On top of that, I'm also going to be rejigging the GUI as well, because originally I generated that template code from Qt Designer, but the way I did it isn't conducive to me adding an extra column so that I can start sort of displaying things like people's profiles and conversation streams and content that's hidden behind a content warning. So I'm hopeful that over the next couple of months I can rejig it a bit so that I can have more of a sound sort of base that I can develop on in the future. Also, it's going to fix a few bugs, particularly related to logins and sort of how I'm storing credentials at the moment, because they're all stored in the local keyring, but there's not necessarily a memory of which ones I've stored. So sometimes there can be some phantom entries that I kind of left in the key store, and I want to make sure that it's obviously tidied up a bit nicer. Another project which I was working on was on an old Raspberry Pi. This is a Revision 1 Model B, and having decommissioned it as a previous own cloud backup type drive, I decided, wouldn't it be cool if I could indulge in a little bit of nostalgia and run RISC OS open on it? So, as a little bit of background, the very first computer I ever used was an Acorn Archimedes A3000 that was in my primary school in the mid to late 90s. RISC OS Open, contrary to its name, is not technically open source or free software. It's RISC OS version 5, which has been released by its parent company so that people are free to use it on the Raspberry Pi. And actually, it's still a surprisingly intuitive system, although perhaps for me it's just the case that I originally learned how to use a computer by middle-clicking on things with a context menu instead of right-clicking. So for me, it feels like I'm going back to basics and it all feels like the natural order of things. I was surprised to discover as well that it's very well supported by free software ports. So if you want to try out things like web browsing or playing FLAC files or playing even some basic games like FreeCiv, it's still a perfectly usable system. So I'm looking forward to continuing to tinker with that over the next month or two to see what I can get it to do and see if there's some kind of useful function I can use beyond, you know, a bit of retro gaming or nostalgia. Another project which I was working on was my malfunctioning gaming rig. So I'd installed a Sapphire-branded AMD RX 480, and what I seemed to find was that after installing Windows on it, because I wanted to use it as a gaming rig, I found that it would just keep crashing sort of midway through a game, which kind of sucked. It turned out that this was because the graphics card wasn't quite receiving enough power, and also the driver for it was very dodgy. Now, removing a USB-C expansion card and making sure that it received enough power seemed to fix it a little bit, but there was a significant driver problem and I wasn't able to resolve that issue. So I took out my new AMD RX 480, which I'd have for about a year, and put in the original MSI-branded AMD R9 380, which actually isn't dissimilar in terms of actual raw performance. I mean, if you look at a benchmark, there's a big gap, but in actual just general performance, you wouldn't notice much of a difference. And actually, that seemed to fix most of the problem, because I ended up reinstalling the driver, dropping it down to a slightly older version, and now everything runs pretty much fine. I think there's still a little bit more tweaking I need to do before it can reliably run Civilization 6, for example, but for less demanding games, even The Sims 4 actually, seems to run perfectly fine. So I think I'll continue sort of tinkering and making sure that that works properly. Now, you might be wondering why I'm only solo booting Windows 8.1 off this gaming rig, and that's because previously I've had some problems with bootloaders and loss of data when I've tried to dual boot off the system, my plan is that I'm going to install sort of a common install of Ubuntu onto an external hard drive, and then whenever I want to use that, which will be pretty much most of the time, I'll just plug that in via a USB port and then just boot off that. That way I don't have to mess with any bootloaders, and I know that I'm not going to mess up my pre-existing system. Also, staying away from gparted will probably help as well. So, what I've also tried to do on my main laptop is experiment with different desktops, because, as I mentioned before, I'm not necessarily the biggest fan of GNOME Shell, although it might just be because I haven't used it very much, so maybe it's something that the more I use it, the more I get used to it. But I had a go with Mate and XFCE, and I found XFCE was great and ran lightning fast, but unfortunately on my high DPI screens, it kind of looked terrible. So I don't know if that's just something silly that I did, or if there's something more that I need to do, but I think that's maybe not the path I'm going to go down. And Mate was great, but I think I've moved on now from having sort of a little bar at the bottom of my screen in addition to the top part of my screen. I feel like that just needlessly restricts screen space. So I guess in many ways, Ubuntu has sort of spoiled me a bit with the Unity desktop, where I've just had a little side panel on one side that's kind of hidden itself away, because that's used then an awful lot less of the screen. So I'm not sure what the path is going to be. I think what I'll do is I'll probably try Ubuntu 18.04 and just see if over time I eventually get used to the desktop, because I think that's more or less what happened with Unity originally, because I moved from the old GNOME style desktop to Unity, got to know and love it, and now obviously they're yanking Unity, so I've got to relearn GNOME Shell. So that'll be an interesting exercise for me. Okay, so final part of the podcast, which is the bi-monthly shoutouts. And again, as by bi-monthly, I in fact mean once every 2 months. So my first shoutout goes to the 8-bit guy on YouTube for recommending the Color Maximite. So for those who've not come across this, this is sort of a custom board. It's designed to appeal to a nostalgic market that wants to code things using 8-bit Z80 compatible BASIC. And essentially, you've just got a board with a VGA and a programmable interface controller, so a PIC, and also a microSD slot as well. And the great thing about the Color Maximite is you could just plug that into a monitor and start programming an old-style BASIC, and it will just run the same way it would with an old microcomputer, but without you having to go out and buy some second-hand kit, which may or may not work or might die on you at any time. Instead, you've got this brand new board and this great big space where you can also mount your own expansions to it and customize it over time. I think the other great thing about the Color Maximite is it has a VGA port, which means that you don't have to worry about having to get composite converters, which is another great addition to it as well. Another shout out goes to Waking Rufus, who has created a rival desktop GUI client for Mastodon using Kotlin. For those who haven't come across Kotlin, this is kind of a dialect of Java that's kind of geared more towards Android development. Now, Kotlin was originally going to be the language I was going to write Mastodon in, but I never got the chance to actually start experimenting with that language, let alone actually developing something useful in it. And the great thing about Kotlin is it allows you to use one common code base to create a desktop application and an Android application. At the moment, his particular GUI client is, much like Mastodon, still in alpha, but I think it's a project that perhaps deserves a little bit of community attention. Another shout-out goes to one Ginny McQueen, who's active on Mastodon, runs her own server, I believe, called kitty.town, and has given me hours of entertainment on Twitch. It's also rekindled my interest in The Sims 4 as well. So go watch her videos, have a look at her Mastodon instance. If you like her, donate to her Patreon. And then as a final shout-out, Dr. Roy Shestovitz deserves all of our thoughts for running Tech Rights and never failing to be interesting. He's a good person to follow on Twitter, Mastodon, and any number of other platforms that he's also on as well. Thank you everybody for listening to the podcast this month. The next podcast is due sometime in May.